copyright can only be justified if it provides a public good. And I can't see that having a copyright life of life plus 70 years, which can be up to 150 years, can be justified as being that it makes any difference to the person who's creating it. You know, if you're young, 10 years is a long time, and if you're old, 10 years is a long time. And in between, you know, 20, 30 years maybe is quite a long time, you know. So I can't think that anyone is going to be incentivized to do some, to invest or to put in more effort or more time or more work because they're going to get paid under a copyright regime for a bit longer than, you know, than another period. In other words, you know, by the time, you know, if you get paid for 10 years or 20 years, you're not going to make any difference to you if you then say, oh no, it's 30 years or 40 years or 50 years. It's not going to make any difference in practice. So I don't really see it. I have certain other views, though. I mean, I do think there's a lot to be said for giving a remuneration right to the performers and the writers so that they can live on their work for a long time as a reward for their creativity, to encourage creativity so that it's a good occupation. I think anything which encourages creativity is a good thing. And if it's a good occupation because you can hope to make money for a lifetime, that's great. That encourages it. I mean, anything which encourages you to get out your little camera, or, you know, someone to pick up a guitar, or someone to write a play or a book or something like that, I think that's good in its own right. And it's also probably very good for the economy, given where we are in the present world. You know, we're not very good at mass producing things anymore in Europe. We're too comfortable, we get paid too much. So we probably have to rely on our wits. Therefore, we should encourage people to be creative and to benefit in that.
So you are a fan of copyright?
I think it does quite a good job. I think it's... I'm a fan of the idea that people get paid for their work. I have real problems with exclusive rights. I think exclusive rights are pretty anti-creative, and I think are excessively powerful weapon. But if you want people to invest in something, whether it's a film or making an expensive record or doing a play, or, you know, some, quite a lot of things take a lot of time and effort and work, and so something which gives you some longer term ability to earn income is good. So I would be quite happy to see a great shortening of exclusive rights in favour of remuneration rights, which is a right to get paid rather than the right to control what you do with my work. Now, there's one issue which I think is important, which is somewhere wrapped up in moral rights. I think there really is a problem of people having their work used in a way that they find really offensive to their deepest soul. So, for instance, there's two things. Say, I manage Billy Bragg, the singer-songwriter. You know Billy Bragg?
No.
Well, okay, he's a sort of political songwriter. Been going for a long time now. But his father died of lung cancer from smoking. And he is a very vigorous campaigner against Nazis and the National Front, especially in his hometown, where there's now one of the sort of centre, most powerful Nazi areas in London, Barking. Now, if his song, he wrote a song called A New England, and if that was used by the National Front as a theme for an advert, he would find that really, you know, he would go nuts. Or if one of his songs was taken and used as an advert for a TV commercial for cigarettes, he would really find that very, very, very offensive. So I think there's got to be some system whereby if people use other people's work, they have an obligation to be sensitive to that other party's views and to be sensitive to it. And I think then the obligation is on the other party to make it clear what their views are, so that, you know, if you're going to use someone's work in a recognisable way, that you A, would have to pay a share of whatever income was acquired from that use, and B, in some sort of a proportionate way, but that B, if you used it in such a way that the writer found it offensive, the artist found it offensive, that you could be A, have to take it down, and B, be found liable for something like a libel. So be a bit like libel law. I think that might be a solution. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know if it's a practical solution, but I do think that there is, you know, something where, you know, like the Smiths, you know, if Morrissey's songs or Chrissy Hynde, their songs were used in any way to, you know, as a hamburger ad, they would go nuts. And I think that's, if I was threatening to remove their right to stop that happening, I would not get their support, and I would like to feel that they would be able to support it. The negative sides are that it can stop people doing things. You know, I think clearly that you know, as Lawrence Lessig has been talking about, you know, moving from a world of read-only to read-write is very interesting, and I have a lot of sympathy for that. And it seems to be the whole idea of sampling is a really important development in art over the last sort of 10, 20 years, and that's going to go on. And I think that at the moment, anyone who samples is in a very difficult financial and legal position, and I think that is not good, and I think that's a really bad. I think also the other thing which is very bad about copyright is that it gives an enormous market power to the people who own the copyrights. So that, for instance, you know, EMI, because they have the Beatles copyrights, have a huge income which they're able to use to maintain their position in the market, versus you starting your record company tomorrow. You know, you wouldn't have that 50 years of copyrights selling for you to underpin your business. I mean, 40 or 50% of EMI's business is back catalogue. That's probably true of most of the major labels. So that sort of underpinning means that they have an enormous competitive advantage in any area which involves money, which in the music business is a lot of areas. That means they can buy the best acts, they can, you know, buy the best advertising, they can bribe and corrupt the radio and the journalists, which they do. They can buy the flashiest websites, you know, pay for the biggest videos and all that stuff, and buy the hottest acts, and buy up the labels who've got the good acts, which is what they do. They can make offers you can't refuse, you know. Mm-hmm. If someone came along to you and said, look, we'll give you 50 million euros for your blog, you'd be very tempted.
Oh, that's a good price.
Yeah, exactly. So everyone has their price, maybe only 10 million, maybe a million. You know, do you know what I mean? So, but that's actually very unhelpful, because it means that new people coming in with new music and new business and new approaches get bought up and just absorbed and lost, and they lose that sort of, that connection with the street. They lose their hunger and their feel and their instinct, and it becomes ossified. You know, you don't want things to become ossified. Music for younger people needs to have new life and new energy all the time. Art needs new life and new energy. You know, you don't want it to become corporate. And that's, I think, the important point is, it's about art, it's about creativity, it's about ideas. You don't want to have, music's about those things, good music. You don't want that all owned by large corporations. And you don't want the new corporation, the new companies, before they become corporations, just being bought up and taken off to the corporations. And that's what's happened. I've been in the music business for 40 years, and I've seen these companies come up and they just get absorbed into the major company. Mm-hmm. Happens all the time.
So the digital revolution, is it an opportunity for musicians, or is it a threat? Why?
Oh, it's an opportunity because recording costs are so much lower, and the access to the market, to the public, to the consumer, to people is so much easier. You know, it basically anyone can do it. You can make a studio. You can have a good studio for, €5,000. You can have a nice microphone, a decent computer, and some good hard drives and some toys. You know, that's incredible. When I started, it was like very expensive. Like, studios were very expensive and very hard to maintain. You had to have lots of engineers and technicians, and recording is cheaper. The distribution is paid for by the consumer now. You don't have to pay. You just put it up on the net, and if people want it, they get to it. So I think in all those sorts of ways, it is an incredible opportunity for people to get into the community. It will raise all sorts of other issues and all sorts of other problems, namely that, how do you get through the noise? And that's, I think, a very interesting thought. How does that work? What communities are going to be built? Because that's the way to get through the news, is community, and it's a question of how communities develop and get built, and how networks develop, and how networks and networks will develop. And I think it's much too early to say, as Chairman Mao said about the French Revolution. I mean, it's like, how could you say what was the impact of the printing press in, after they just printed the Gutenberg Bible? I mean, it's incredibly new. I mean, to be able to download in real time music is, very easily is only happened in the last 2 or 3 years, really, hasn't it? Well, in a widespread way. Before that, it was all a bit, sitting there and wait, another 73%, sorry about that. It's important, it should be one of the first questions: how can artists get paid? And I would think that one of the answers is something like some sort of hidden flat fee for people with high-speed connections, broadband connections, whether it's on the phone or whether it's on the internet. And, if you say that you're never going to listen to music, that's fine, you needn't pay it. But if you do listen to music and you haven't paid it, then I would be quite happy to see you prosecuted and fined quite severely, because it's mean, if you're not willing to pay, a euro or two a week, for the use of music. I think that's a mean bastard, if you're deaf, or if you're blind, or if you're handicapped, or if you're on social security. I mean, I'm willing to think about all the sort of people who ought to have, that should be freely available in the library, and you can burn it onto CDs if you, I'm really open on making it as unrestricted as possible, but if people have got money, they should pay a little bit towards it. And if everybody paid, the figures are enormous. So if you had 50 million people in Germany, or 50 million connections all paying €4 a month, that's €50 a year, more or less. Let's say €50 a year is €2.5 billion. That's probably bigger than the current German record business. Then I think I would say that you could then think of all sorts of other new ways of developing and delivering music which people might like. And I think a lot of it, especially on the phones, I think the phones are really what's going to be interesting. Because the phones, I think if I was the iPod, if I was Stephen Jobs, I'd be making sure I'm making my money quick. And if I was Nokia, I'd be worried about the iPod phone. I suspect I'll put my money on Nokia. I mean, Nokia are the biggest camera maker in the world now, aren't they? And I would think they'll probably be the biggest sort of portable music receiving device. Portable handheld computer device in a few years, because everybody will have them. They'll have huge capacities, and people will be able to download music. Now, I think once it's portable, what you're going to want is a lot of streaming. You're not going to want to have to fiddle around too much. So then that becomes interesting. It's, I mean, obviously some people create their own streams and real fans, but there'll be also people like me who are more lazy and will just want to have stuff provided. So then there's going to be who's going to provide the music? It could be podcasters. You know, you could provide it, the music, which I might like to hear. If you have advertising on it, you're going to have to pay for it to someone, not a lot, but a little percentage of your income. If you're just doing it because you're a fan, then you probably won't have to pay, which is great. And I'm really going to be interested in what someone, if I find someone who recommends music that I like, I'm going to find that really good, and I'm going to use that as a lead to find other music. So I think a lot of niche markets will develop. I do think it will be about niche markets and about networks and about networks and networks and things. And it becomes very interesting then, because, you know, you might find that there's 100,000 people around the world, you know, who like this sort of music, and suddenly if you can get to all of them, you've got a market of 100,000 people, you can make a very good living. And that's the key. The whole key is, if you can get a crowd, you can make a living. We may not know quite how at this point, but I know that if there's 100,000 people who like your music, you can make a living.
You are a fan of file sharing?
Not particularly. I don't do it myself particularly, but I recognise that it's there and it's a reality. And I know that a lot of people like doing it, and I think, well, okay, I've got no problems with it. You know, if it means I don't have to make CDs and have trucks driving around and people just sending music to each other, that's great. If people are interested in music and are enjoying music and are discovering new things and new music, and they're getting off and they're talking to each other about it, whether it's physically, face-to-face or online or whatever, I think that's great. I think that's good for the country, I think that's good for the world. I think if people talk more about music and less about how much they hate Muslims, that's really a good thing, and more about the Muslim music they like, that would be good for us all, you know.
Suing file sharers seems not to be a good strategy for you, or...
Who?
Suing?
Oh, no, that's a terrible strategy. Hmm? You know, it was a strategy while they couldn't think what to do, but I think the point is it's too late now. The biggest mistake the record companies made was not doing a deal with Napster. Napster offered to do a deal with them, and they didn't take it. They thought they could do it without Napster. They didn't need it, and so it was like, well, fuck you, you know, we're going to sue you out of existence. Subsequently, I've heard a lot of people say, it's a pity we ever closed Napster, because it was centralised. You know, it meant they could get to the people, they were willing to pay. At that point, they hadn't really got into it being free, particularly no one would have minded much paying, and it would have set up a business model, and they really fucked it up. It's going to be harder to do now than it would have been then. The only thing they've learned from YouTube is that that these things happen and that you have to go with it, and the only thing they learned was that once YouTube was sold for $1.5 billion, they better try and get some of the money. And they did. What they did is they were given shares in YouTube before it was transferred. So in effect, the labels got given, the four major labels got $50 million each, which doesn't go to the artists, which just goes straight to their bottom line. And I'm sure they've also agreed that they're not going to sue on behalf of their artists. So in effect, what they've done is that for $200, they've let someone who've used their music walk away with $1.5 billion. I think it's shocking. It just shows how the desperate state they're in. Mm-hmm. You know, they should have got a lot more than that. They should at least have got, you know, I don't know. I mean, I would have thought they should have got 10% of the income. You know, YouTube wouldn't have been sold for $1.5 billion had there not been music. Which they didn't have any permission for. It was breach of copyright. I mean, you know, for God's sake, that's what they've been sending the kids to, you know, ruining old ladies and suing dead grandmothers for. Mm. You know, that's being done on a massive, flagrant scale. And the thing is, they couldn't license it. You can't license YouTube. You know, it's impossible to get a license for someone singing a song which they didn't write, or for putting a new vocal or singing along on a a track with somebody else, with some video of somebody else, and with no income, no advertising, you can't license, it's unlicensable. It's clearly unlicensable, it's clearly gross, fragrant, sort of, And they could have said it up until the time they were sold that they didn't make any money and they were just doing it for the kids, and it would have been hard to get any, you couldn't, no point in suing because they had no money. They've just gone into liquidation. Mm. Now they think, oh great, it's fantastic promotion, but that's crazy. I mean it is, but that's, it's like saying radio is fantastic promotion. Yeah, I know, but we also want to get paid for use of music because it's the music which promotes the radio. Just as much as the radio promotes the music. There's not a lot of future for music radio without any music.
When I listen to IFB and their press releases, they expect a high increase of music sales.
No, they know it's not happening. They know it's not happening.
Why?
They know. They're too clumsy. It's too much hassle. It makes you think about it. You see, the great thing about what I'm talking about, the idea of blanket licensing of some sort or another, is that it feels free. So it doesn't matter if you get a song and you don't like it, you throw it away, you get another song. You don't like it, you throw it away, get another song. Oh, I like that, I'll keep that, you may have it and think, well, maybe I like that, I'm not sure. And then you can listen to it for a bit longer and inside, oh, you do like it, or it's a crappy song, you throw it away. So I think that, what it does is, why the record companies didn't like it was because it took control away. The internet permits the possibility of what I call altruistic filters to develop, which is filters which are driven by people who are enthusiasts about music or who have a view about music or whatever. And what the record companies like is filters which are driven by money, and there's no question in my mind that the radio, the press, the magazines and all the things, the DJs, are all driven indirectly or directly by money. They're all about, well, we've got to cover that record because then they'll advertise in here, or we've got to play that record because they'll bring us these acts and this thing, or we're going to play that record because it's going to be very popular because the last one was a hit and that's going to bring in, the audience, and that's going to mean we can put up our advertising rates, or keep our advertising going. And so the whole, even on state radio, there's this concern for their ratings. They know that if no one listens to their radio, then the landlord are less likely to go on paying for it. So they think, oh God, we're going to keep something which is relevant to the kids. So there's a certain amount of, of guessing and what everybody wants to play hits, state radio as much as commercial radio. And no one knows what a hit is, but that if they're spending a lot of money on it, it's more likely to be a hit than if they're not spending a lot of money on it. Or at least you'll listen to it. I mean, given how many records there are coming out, unless it's got quite a lot of money being spent on it, you might not, if you're at a radio station, you might not hear it, you might not listen to it. So that's what I mean, the filters are very money-driven. And I think what happens when the filters are altruistic and are driven by just people's enthusiasms and their mad discoveries is really a wonderful idea. Or the experts, the amateur experts, could be very different sort of music coming through. And I think that it will tend to be less mass market, more niche markets. I mean, as I said, the age of the mass market might be going, and we may be coming into the era of the massive niche markets, because the internet also makes it very much more expensive to try the old mass market model. You don't just have the one TV station which you put the advert on and everybody's going to watch it, or the one video channel you get your video on and everybody's going to see it. There's a million channels, and there are a lot of channels now, and there's going to be a lot more next year, and there's going to be a lot more the year after that. So we're all going to have to keep on our toes.
So what's your opinion on digital rights management, which is useless?
Oh, digital rights management, useless, useless. It's a complete pain in the arse. And the worst thing is that it turns people off buying music, and it also it costs more, probably the DRM on most things gets more money than the artist. Yeah, very expensive, and it won't happen on mobile phones because it takes too much space and costs too much to buy the licenses. And I think everybody realises that DRM is, I think the public's spoken. You know, the public has spoken, and they've spoken very loudly that they do not like DRM. You know, iTunes sales are not going up anymore. They're only going up by extending the territories. I mean, in a way, that was almost admitted again by John Kennedy yesterday. He said, European sales of iTunes are catching up with American sales. What does that tell you? It tells you that the American sales have stopped growing. And that's what's happened. They've hit a plateau. You know, they're not, I mean, they may be growing a bit, but probably just with the increasing spread of the devices rather than in the usage per device. You know, because, you know, you don't want to buy, you know, when you can just copy it off of your record or off your friend's record or get downloaded for free and do whatever you like with it, why pay for something which you can only use, which is costs you more and is less functional? This doesn't sound like a good deal. I think they're learning. I think you'll find, look back on this interview in a year's time and see where it's got to. I think it will have gone a long way in this respect. I think they know that the market wants unprotected files. And we've got to find a way of making, of monetizing, it's an ugly word, but you know, monetizing the fact that people want to explore the music or just have music available, and they don't want to have to make constant purchase decisions. They just want to have music. Then I think they'll go and buy CDs still. I still think they'll buy CDs. I think there'll be a smaller market for CDs, but I think it'll be more expensive, and I think it'll be more sort of like a premium market. It's like, you know, going to see the cinema rather than just sitting at home and watching TV, you know.
We have collecting societies which are controlling an exclusive right of the artist.
Yeah.
And for example, artists are not allowed to release music under Creative Commons licenses.
Yeah, well, I mean, all that stuff is going to change. That's not going to happen. That's not going to last. That's, you know, I know. It's inexcusable. I mean, the other side is that the Creative Commons have historically been very... they've had this slightly patronising view as, oh, well, musicians can go off and they can always earn more money selling T-shirts and doing gigs, and why do they need to earn money off of records? Well, that's not for them to decide. Fuck you. That's not for you to decide. But at the same time, I don't think it's for the collection societies to decide how artists want to deal with their rights. I think that people are often ill-advised about with their Creative Commons licenses. I think they should be more careful and go deeper into it and see which one they want. And then there's the problem of finding administration. And I do think the collector and societies have got to find a way of dealing with it. But equally, I think the Creative Commons have got to find a way of adjusting the way they think a little bit so that they can work together, you know, work out so that their systems can work with... You know, you can't have hundreds of different systems, or else the transaction costs become unbelievable. You're not going to get any money. No one's going to get any money from, from the collection societies. So, I think it'll get worked out. Frankly, I can't see why it won't.
If you could talk to German politicians who are still reforming the European Copyright Directive, what would you tell them in a short, in some...
Well, I think they should be very careful about any form of criminal sanctions on breaking DRM. I think they should be very careful about digging in DRM. I think DRM is culturally and historically could be a catastrophe. I think there's really is a problem with orphan works and, you know, with length of copyright. There's some very serious problems about, you know, people not being able to reproduce works because no one knows who has the rights. And I think that's something which I think they should look at. I think there should be some, they should deal with the issue of orphan rights. And I think they should do nothing which makes it harder for people to access information. And I think that anything which means that you can't get information unless you pay for it is not a good idea. I think that's very, in some senses, literally antisocial, certainly antisocialist. You know, I think that really there should be a commitment to having information available for anyone who wants to. And if you don't have access to information, then I think that's as almost as bad as not having any food. You know, and I think you should think of it in those ways, or having ill health. I mean, we wouldn't think any more now in Europe of maybe saying, oh, well, if you haven't saved up enough money and you've got cancer, tough shit, you know. And we wouldn't think, oh, well, you can't afford to go to school, so tough shit. And I think in the same way, we shouldn't think in terms of people having to pay to have access to information. I think it's quite reasonable to expect people to pay for making money out of their access. That I've got no problem with. But not being able to access it. So for instance, it seems to me anything where you've reasonably looked and seen who owns the book and you can't find out the book or the record, you can't find them, you can't get permission, you should be able to print it and just have a remuneration. I think we've got to move towards remuneration rights. And I think exclusive rights are really, if you're campaigning with the government about what's going on, I think you should be focusing on the on whether exclusive rights really are the right way to be going. The more and more I think about it, the more and more I'm coming to the view that exclusive rights are the problem. And this has taken me a long time to get there. I mean, I've been thinking about these rights with regards to the internet for the last 5, 6, 7 years, you know. And my views have been changing and shifting and developing and so on, you know. And that's where I am at the moment. I suspect I may well be wrong and I may change my view, but at the moment I'm very worried about exclusive rights, except in as much as I was talking to you about earlier, and that's a moral context. So remuneration rights, yes, no problem. Length of time, I think that we should be thinking about that too. Certainly no longer. And I think it's very hard to see why records have only 50 years and the underlying song has life plus 70 years. And I couldn't see how we could possibly justify records going up to life plus 70 years. So I can't see how we can justify life plus 70 years for, you know, books and writings and films. And these extensions only gone on because of Disney. You know, and all the arguments. I mean, it was interesting, there was a debate I went to in the UK about extending copyright right life on recordings, and the people came down from the British IFP, called the BPI, and they more or less, they'd obviously had so many batterings, they came down to think, well, we want the money from the companies, we want the money. Well, yeah, okay, well, we don't want to give you the money. You know, when it comes to that, you know, at least they were honest enough to say that was what it was. You say, well, there you go, of course you do, don't we all? Tough shit.
Okay, thank you very much for the interview.
It's a pleasure.